Oh, it was a magical day. It was so magical, and it was so well done, very organized, as you can imagine. And we did get a chance to meet him and speak with him for a few minutes, and with Michelle Obama, because it was a they had a little photos of each person, each artist. And I just said to him, I'd been thinking, what am I going to say to him? And I just said, we were very blessed to have you as president. And then he said, we're very blessed to have your work. I was, oh, okay, thank you. But
Wow.
it was very, very special because, and well, because he even said that it was one of his favorite days of the year to do the art, the National Medal of Arts and also Humanities. And that level of awareness, even if he might not have known all the people's work in the room, just that idea of affirming the arts and humanities in the society. And I feel that that's changed for the worse now.
Well, that was only in 2015, and it seems like a lifetime ago.
It does.
And I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about the power of music and art to restore some of what we've lost in the last few years.
I believe that art is the antidote to the poison. And I think that the arts are very, very healing to people. There's a kind of sense of, what would I say, upliftedness or just an awareness of the larger picture that really transcends culture or transcends particular political situations. Or, there's a timeless aspect to art that I think is very healing for people to be part of. And I think somehow in a climate like this, my sense is that I'm digging my heels in even more, and I'm very stubborn about doing my work and doing the best I can to get it to people, to give them some hope in this world.
What are you feeling from audience members and students that you work with?
A wonderful sense of communication and enthusiasm. I think there is a longing for these values, and sometimes I'm afraid that when people are not exposed to things that they don't know what they don't know or they don't know what they're missing. But I sense a kind of longing of, and we're just human beings on this earth, and we want the earth to go on. I'm very impressed with the young people who are really doing so much protest and putting so much energy into having a future. So as an artist, sometimes I'm thinking, what can I do that's useful? And I'm not sure how useful it is because I don't reach so many people. But I think that, like, for example, in the piece that we performed last night at University of Rochester, Sell Your Songs, it really offers a kind of alternative society or an alternative culture, which is really one of interdependence rather than cruelty. It's really kindness instead of violence, and it's really generosity instead of greed. And there's also a sense of cooperation rather than competition.
Well, how is it related to the biology of cellular structures and society? How does that tie that theme together?
Well, I was inspired by reading Siddhartha Mukherjee's piece. It's a book, I think he won a Pulitzer for it, called The Emperor of All Maladies. And it's basically a history of cancer and cancer research from ancient times, which is very interesting, that they might not have called it cancer in ancient times, but it has existed. So I've always been very interested in that. How do diseases come into this world?
What did they call it?
I'm not sure, actually.
But it
I don't
existed.
remember. It existed. I mean, it sounds like it certainly did, from accounts of the time. But what I was really interested in was the miracle of the cell. Because he's writing about cells that are not functioning, but those are really not the standard. The standard is that each of our cells is this miraculous organism of billions of little units that are cooperating. And then if you take that into the whole body, the way that the cells are cooperating with each other to make life continue, I mean, it's really miraculous, the intelligence of even one cell. So that's what really inspired me. And I feel that I've been working for a number of years now. The piece that I made before Cellular Songs was called On Behalf of Nature. And I think that I've been really thinking about how to make ecological art just as a reminder to human beings about what we're in danger of losing. My work is very poetic, and because I'm a musician, it's not that verbal. There are, maybe might be a few little pieces of text, but very, very little, a very few pieces. So I think that my impulse is to really, in a sense, convey or channel the energies of nature that we are in danger of losing, so that that inspiration might make people think a second thought about things rather than being explicitly political.
So, for example, hocketing, how does that work into that idea?
It's very, very interdependent. If one person falls, both people fall. And Cellular Songs is so interesting to work with. You know, it's a 5-woman cast, and every performance is whole. You know, as I said last night, it was very much like riding bucking broncos, and we were staying on those horses, and that's the excitement of it. If one person messes up, then we're all there, and it's just so challenging in a great way musically. It's very, very, very intricate, and it's so exciting. It's very much like it probably never will be perfect, and if it ever was perfect, it would be really boring. So it's like a journey without goal or something like that, and so that's what makes it very exciting.
Well, I want to go back a little bit. I know that you were born with an eye condition, mm-hmm. and your family enrolled you in Dalcroze Eurythmics.
Yes, that's right.
What is that for people that don't know what that is, and how did that shape the artist that you are?
Well, Dalcroze was a composer in Switzerland in the late 19th century, and I think he was also a teacher. He was working in some ways like Bartok ended up working. He was taking Swiss folk music and then composing pieces from that. But in his teaching, he came across people that were very good musicians, but they weren't very good in rhythm, one man particularly. And so he watched his movement, the way that he walked, and saw that he had a real flow to his movement. And so he developed these physical exercises to work with rhythm, and the young man learned rhythm. So he developed a series of physical exercises to teach rhythm. I remember that very well as a little, I mean, only started when I was 3 years old. So that's one branch of his pedagogical methodology. And the second branch was improvisation. And the third was the solfège system, which is the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do system of scales. But I remember we learned with our arms down at the low do and our arms going up the steps, so that you got that sense of sound in space. It was much easier to learn that way. And so those principles of space, the body, Dalcroze also said at one point that all musical ideas come from the body, or, you know, originate in the body. So I didn't realize how much that had influenced me. I worked with these wonderful Polish sisters, the Rom sisters, from the time I was 3 to the time I was 7. And I didn't realize how much it had affected me until I was working on my opera. I was writing an opera for Houston Grand Opera, and some of the people in the cast were classically trained opera singers. And they were having a hard time with my rhythmic articulation.
Well, I wondered about that, because you're working in these very rarefied institutions that teach their students to use their voices in very specific, mm-hmm. narrow
yes.
ways to create a beautiful, specific effect.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And how does that tension play out in your workshops and when you're working with young singers? And what kind of reaction do you get? And what would you want a young classically trained singer to take away from one of your workshops?
I think that the Western European tradition has wonderful qualities, and I still study to this day. I've been working with my teacher for the last 35 years, and she's miraculous. I think I wouldn't have had the longevity of my singing if I hadn't done that. And also, it's really like a maintenance and you know, a discipline of strength and flexibility. I mean, I really, really feel that it has very strong qualities, very positive qualities. But the way it's taught sometimes is very linked up with fear. And I think that now people are starting to understand that there is no separation between the voice and the body. So if you think of the voice also as a kinetic instrument, it actually makes singing come out in a much more organic and lively way, and it does not take away from strength and precision at all. It actually just adds to the range of the voice. And I also think that some of the younger teachers are realizing that even opening up the voice to other qualities just as a way of exploring the possibilities and resources of the voice in some ways can inform the classical interpretation of a singer.
So you would strip
and can really, you know, add color and all kinds of possibilities of even within that repertoire.
So you would strip away the fear and maybe some unlock some of the potential of the voice.
Yes, just to explore, you know, and then go back to that repertoire. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I'm not so interested in that particularly. I'm much more interested in taking that exploration and then composing from that. But also, performers are now becoming much less afraid of moving as when they're singing. I saw that beautiful production at the Met of Lulu, and the woman that played Lulu was unbelievable. I mean, she was just a force of nature, and the voice was beautiful and incredible, and her movement was extraordinary. So I think what I'm trying to do is to just take away the boundaries of the voice being separate from the body. And I think that that sense of movement really helps the voice. And also another thing that classical musicians are not taught that much is the use of space. The voice in space, what does that do? Space is an ally. So, you know, I teach that a lot.
Well, you've sung at Carnegie Hall, and mm-hmm. That's a wonderful space.
Oh, wonderful space.
Yeah. What is your teacher working with you on right now?
Just maintenance. You know, I'm not a young singer now, so maintenance strength. I think that mid-range, you kind of lose, there's a possibility of losing strength and flexibility. I mean, it's just what you would think it would be. Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful. And I think that she is a remarkable teacher because she works with people from different disciplines, so classical singers, but also jazz singers. Theo Bleckman, who's in my ensemble, also works with her, and Luciana Souza. I mean, some really fine jazz singers. She works with Broadway people.
What's your teacher's name?
Jeanette Levetri. She works with Broadway people who are hurting their voices by belting incorrectly. She works with rock and roll people that are hurting their voices. And she's so remarkable physically. She knows so much about the voice. She's a wonderful singer herself, but I think early on she had some vocal problems as a young singer and worked through those problems. And, you know, I always think when people have any kind of injury or harm, if they really work well, they know much more about their instrument. She had to work through and find things out. And she's always growing and exploring, and she knows so much about the voice that doctors go to her and they ask her to teach at Johns Hopkins in the voice department. I mean, she really, really knows a lot about the voice.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get to some of the spiritual practices of maintaining your life as an artist, but I want to ask you about this trilogy. So you're here in Rochester to perform the Cellular Songs, but you're working on three pieces of a set, Indra's Net.
In a way, I feel like that it's come to that. I wouldn't have thought of that. I always just think of it piece by piece, but I was thinking lately, maybe Indra's Net is the third part of this trilogy about going deeply into nature and the I would call it like the machine of life, you know, I mean the organic machine of life, just the energy of life force.
What's at the heart of it then? Is there a sort of a Buddhist tenet in the whole thing?
I'm sure I am a Buddhist practitioner. I'm sure that's influenced it, but I think it's more just loving life. Wanting it to go on, wanting this earth to go on at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And just working with despair, actually, really. I mean, I feel like my working on my art keeps me out of being in despair all the time.
Well, I think a lot of people are reporting more anxiety in their lives, more despair.
It's
certainly
very hard.
We've seen the rise of fascism.
Definitely.
In the last few
and that's
years.
Been a theme of a number of my pieces over the years. Mm-hmm. I did a piece called Quarry in 1976, which was an opera, and it was really a meditation on World War II, but it was a little wider than World War II. The source was World War II, but it really was a meditation on these cycles of war and fascism. And then in the 80s, I worked on a piece called The Games. It was collaboration with Ping Chong, and we were working in Berlin, and it was definitely a piece about the end of the world and this fascist society on another planet. So, you know, it's that theme has come up. And in a way, I think that, you know, it's very important to also convey the power of history. I think that young people sometimes, because of the internet and the way that we have so much information, we're kind of overwhelmed with information. There's not a sense of curiosity being taught in our school systems. I feel that there's no curiosity about the past. And I mean, of course, young people, you know, they're very in the moment and they're thinking a lot about the future, but it's ridiculous. If you don't know your past, it's going to come up again. And that I could see this coming years ago, because I've been studying this. I mean, I've been a student of World War II my whole life, and, you know, trying to figure out what was going on there. You know, imagine like a whole world in cataclysm and conflict. What was actually going on? And to see this coming back up again, and to see that we could have prevented this, because I think that young people are just not taught it. It's not their fault. It has to do with the educational system.
Well, what you have, I mean, the vision and the creative force that you have is really extraordinary. Was there a point in your young life where you felt like sort of this electric shock, or someone said something to you, or, you know, how is it that you developed your own sense of curiosity and imagination?
I was so fortunate to go to Sarah Lawrence at the time. And I think the wonderful thing about that school is I think what I learned from Sarah Lawrence is just the love of learning. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go back to when they have these reunions, and they give classes, so you can go and take a class. And at one time, I just observed, just walked into the room for a second. And I observed this class, and there were women there from the 1930s and 40s. I mean, it was unbelievable. And the level of that conversation, and the curiosity, and the enthusiasm for learning. And I just thought, wow, I'm so blessed to have gone to that school at that particular time, because I love to learn. I mean, that keeps me going. Discovery, learning, curiosity. So that is what I would love to convey to young people, because I think that our world would, you know, we would have some hope for our world if there was that kind of curiosity, and the sense that it's not like learning about wars and histories particularly. It's much more looking at the bigger picture of cycles of these impulses and how they come back and back and back. So I'm not particularly working on that right now in my work as a kind of explicit theme, but I feel like more stubborn as an artist now. I mean, I really feel that we just have to do something. And so I think the pieces that I'm working on are much more about nature and maybe possible alternative societies or ways of behavior, human behavior, as a kind of antidote.
Do you think that humans are good or bad or neutral?
The good thing about the Buddhist practice is there is a sense that we all have basic goodness as human beings, that we're born with what they would call Buddha nature, which is basic goodness. And part of our problem is that what we learn starts covering it over. And then it becomes habitual behavior. So that, you know, in a sense, meditation is about getting back to what we started out with, which is clear and pure. So that's a nice way of thinking about things, that your natural state is pure.
You're perfect as you are.
Yeah, perfect as you are. But I love that there's a Zen Buddhist teacher, Suzuki Roshi, who would say to his students, "You're perfect as you are, but you could use a little bit of work." That's, I think, what says it in one sentence.
Well, what do you do as an artist to maintain your own spiritual health? Do you have to unplug from the news sometimes?
Oh, yes. I'm lucky enough that I have some land in New Mexico, and so I go there 3 times a year where I do completely unplug. I don't hear the radio at all. In New York, I listen to NPR every day. I feel like the people on the radio are my friends. But those months that I'm in New Mexico, to not hear what's going on, and then I come back and nothing's really changed. It's just a variation It's so strange. It's very strange. And I have, and in that environment, I'm much more able to do my discipline, which is sitting and then, you know, being at the keyboard every day and vocalizing. You know, I read a lot there too. The reading is something that I think is, again, getting lost a little bit in our world. And reading is, you know, I just love to read.
What are you reading right now?
Well, I just finished a wonderful book by Mingyur Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan Buddhist teacher, and it's called Love of This World. And he did a very interesting thing. He was born in, you know, a real classical traditional family where his father was a very famous teacher, and he was always venerated. You know, he was going to be this great teacher as a child. And there was a part of him that realized that he needed to go on what they call a pilgrimage of a few years to eliminate those kinds of ideas about himself. So he literally gave up everything. He went for a 3 to 4 year retreat, what they call a wandering retreat, and gave up his robes and had to, you know, got food by begging. I mean, gave up everything basically, and he almost died. And he writes about that, you know, where he all these signs, he was really ill because he got some food from scraps from a restaurant. And literally, I mean, before this decision that he made and the trip that he made, he didn't know how to order, you know, he didn't know how to go up into a railroad station and get a ticket. I mean, everything had always been done for him. So it's an amazing, amazing book.
Are there other spiritual practices that are really restorative to you that you'd want to share with other artists?
Basically, I've been, you know, just being beginner's mind all the time. And I basically just, if I do spiritual, with quotation marks, practice, it's just straight meditation. But I consider doing my art and the discipline of doing my art a spiritual practice. And I learned so much from that. There was a time where I would say one practice was separate from the other. And the longer that I go on living and working, I feel that it's all one thing. So, you know, working on my artwork is a spiritual discipline. And I feel that over the years, I understand that there's nothing wrong with trying to do art that's of benefit. There's nothing to be ashamed of. It's not corny. It's really necessary.
Are there people that think
of benefit to sentient beings? I think as a young artist, you never talked about that. I mean, it wasn't cool
to be.
It wasn't intellectual enough or something to actually say, you know, I'm really trying to do work of benefit to sentient beings. And now I just feel, hey, you know, I mean, what is there to lose? I just feel that it's so important.
You want to be uplifting.
And also, but not in a, you know, not in a non-critical way. And again, I feel that there's always a misunderstanding that Buddhism particularly is some kind of, I don't even want to say the word religion because it really isn't. It's really more a philosophy where everybody's going to be happy all the time and you're going to have this smile on your face and it's going to be angelic. It's just the opposite. It's really leaning into the hard places. There, you know, the teacher Trungpa Rinpoche used to say, it's like licking honey off the edge of a very sharp knife. That you literally lean into the hard places. That, you know, pain is part of life. Suffering is something else. Suffering is the way you react to pain. But I would never want my art to not have pain. Pain is part of life. It's not just everything's wonderful. You know, no, it's not that at all.
Is creating like that for you sometimes?
Oh, of course. I'm afraid every time. After all these years, I'm thinking, I've been working more than 50 years and I'm still terrified. But there always gets to be a point if I, you know, now I know how to talk to myself a little bit more. I always have these doubts and insecurities, and I'm not sure that that's not a good thing. Because I think that some people do repeat the same thing over and over again. And my choice has been to have the pain and the fear of living in the unknown. But I love that. You know, it's more like being a scientist, you know, being a scientist in a way. You know, that exploration. So now I know when it's coming up to not get overwhelmed by it. I know how to work with it a little bit better after all these years. And I know how to work little by little. I say that to myself, and also remain playful as long as I can. So now what happens for me is that if I find a tiny little thing that I'm excited about, it's a clue. I feel that it's more like I'm a detective, and it's a clue. And little by little, I start getting very curious, and then the fear goes away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you want to talk about, an interesting story that's...
Well, I can tell you a little bit about that experience of having that medal put around my neck by Obama. So he, in the ceremony, read a text, or it was a speech that he had written about all of us as artists and you know, what that meant. And he got a quote of mine, which I don't really know where it came from, but I must have said it or written it, you know, in the past. And he said, "Sometimes I'm in fashion and sometimes I'm not." So he said, "I can identify with that." And I said that it doesn't really matter. I just have to keep on trucking because I need to create. And then he said something like, "All of the people in this room have that urgency of creating." And when he put the medal over my head, I was determined to give him a hug. I think everybody were like deers in the headlights, but I was determined I was going to give him a hug. And I'm tiny and he's very, very tall. So he bent down and I whispered in his ear, "Keep on trucking." And he said, "There's nothing else to be done right now, or there's nothing else we can do." So that, and everybody asked me, "What did you actually whisper in his ear?" I said, "Keep on trucking."
That is funny.
First I said, "God bless you and thank you." But, you know, the second hug, I said, "Keep on trucking."
No one else hugged him?
Well, then from that point on, everybody did. I was determined. But I think from that point on, the hugs got longer and longer as the afternoon wore on. It was so, so moving. And the end of it, well, I will tell you this part of the story, which was really blew my mind. So there was a very fine, I guess it's called the President's Orchestra or the President's Band. So it's basically a brass band, but with a string section.
Okay.
And they were playing the President's March or something like that?
Ruffles
dun,
and...
Dun, da, 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 you know, that
I think it's
one.
Called Ruffles and Flourishes or
Ruffles
something.
Ruffles and Flourishes. And they were playing show tunes while we were waiting. They had us wait. I think he was meeting someone else. You know, it was something very important, some international meeting that was different than the artist's meeting. And so we waited for a while and they were playing show tunes. So I thought, you know, very nice, but okay. And then after the whole ceremony, and I was pretty overwhelmed to begin with because I was almost in tears to start out with. And I heard them playing, I think it was probably Handel, and beautifully. There's a picture of me standing there. Nobody else was listening, but I just stood and listened to them. They were so good. So I did thumbs up after it was over, and the conductor came up to me and congratulated me, and he said, "Do you hear something?" And the pianist was playing something, and it was my piece. I just couldn't believe it. You know, it just seemed like those when worlds collide. And I was overwhelmed. I just burst out into tears, and then I had to leave.
What was the piece that they were playing?
Travel Song. It was a female pianist. And I just couldn't believe that. How did they know my obscure little music? You know, how did they find that? It was just knocked me out, and that was it. And then I had to leave. I was overwhelmed.
Well, it's a happy scene to imagine. Yes. All that synergy, all those artists at the White House celebrating the arts, celebrating the humanities. And, you know, that's a pendulum that will swing back the
so
other
great.
Way.
It was so great. Yeah. And some of the other artists were so wonderful. I mean, and wonderful writers in the humanities. I mean, it was very special.
Yeah. Well, congratulations
Thank
on
you very
what
much.
Is continuing to be an inspiring career for so many.
Thank you.